From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The giant oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico has dealt a harsh blow to communities up and down the coast, threatening wildlife, fisheries, and tourism in parts of all five Gulf states. But the disaster is particularly alarming for people who live on the fragile edge of Louisiana. For decades, they've battled to save a vanishing land. In part one of an ongoing series, The Disappearing Coast, NPR's Debbie Elliott follows one family of Cajun shrimpers as they adapt to this latest threat.
Hey, you gonna pick up those life jackets?
Yeah.
Okay.
David Chauvin is seeing his wife, Kim, out the kitchen door. She's rushing off to attend a BP safety meeting. Instead of selling shrimp from the dock behind their house, the former high school sweethearts are now running a fleet of 25 shrimp boats that have been converted to skimmers.
One year you go from pulling trawls to oil booms. You couldn't even imagine. If I'd had the weirdest dream I'd ever had and the scariest dream I've ever had, I don't think I could even imagine something like this. Yeah. I mean, I went from carrying, delivering shrimp around to now I deliver personnel and supplies for BP around.
The Chauvins live in their namesake, Chauvin, Louisiana, a small stretch of dry land just off Lake Boudreaux in Terrebonne Parish. They own the Mariah Jade Shrimp Company and have three large shrimping vessels built by David and his father, Anthony.
All three of my children, all three of my boats are named after. Yeah, Mariah, we've been bringing her aboard the Mariah Jade since she was a baby. She, my wife and my daughter and my two sons, they would come with me all summer long.
The sons, who used to splash around as toddlers in the boat's saltwater tanks, now captain two of the shrimp trawlers. And 14-year-old Mariah Jade helps her mom manage the loading dock out back where other local fishermen bring their harvest. Shrimping has been a family affair for the Chauvins for five generations. David's great-grandfather, Cap Chauvin, was doing it long before oil was discovered off the Louisiana coast. Today, oil rigs are as common as shrimp trawlers. David Chauvin says he never realized how devastating a spill could be. It came into focus those first days after the Deepwater Horizon exploded when he was approached by a representative from BP.
This thing was actually still burning offshore, and he explained to me the situation. They had never had this happen in this amount of water. And trying to fix this problem is probably just as bad as trying to fix it on the moon. So my heart sank in my chest and I'm thinking, okay, how bad is this gonna be?
The man asks him to assemble a team of shrimpers to help with the cleanup.
And at that time, I mean, we weren't affected at all. The boats were still fishing. Our season had just started to crank up. So I said, tell you what, I said, let me pray on it, let me sleep on it, and I'll get back with you first thing in the morning. And that night I didn't sleep at all.
For 21-year-old David Chauvin Jr., the decision was clear.
Well, I mean, it was either go shrimping or go save a coastline.
A coastline that was already in peril. Louisiana loses the equivalent of a football field of land every 15 minutes. Nearly 25 square miles a year. David Chauvin Sr. says in his 20 years of fishing the Gulf, he's seen the land vanish.
As that those barrier islands disappeared, well, now you get wave action that used to wash up on the beaches, actually travels all the way into the marsh areas now. And the salt water, of course, killed all the oak trees. Oak trees need fresh water. There are places that we fish and drag the nets now. You can hang the nets. And tear the nets, and those are actually oak trees where there was land at one time.
You can see why it's happening in the marsh due south of Chauvin.
All right, so here we are, right, we're leaving from Cocodrie, and we'll just give you a quick tour around the marshes.
The Disappearing Coast is a field of study for Alex Kolker, an assistant professor at the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. He navigates a small boat through the deep green grass that stretches for miles around.
The story is this area, it's sinking. And of course, you know, some of this wetland loss is part of the natural delta cycle, right? You should have areas of natural growth and decay. The problem is we've accelerated the decay and cut off the growth.
Cut off the growth with levees and navigation channels that choke off the sediment that would naturally flow from the Mississippi River to feed the marsh. and accelerated the decay by carving up wetlands for industrial purposes, like oil and gas exploration. You can see the result, where broken up patches of marsh dot what is now open water.
The scale of the wetland loss here is tremendous. We've lost something close to 20% of the wetlands of the Mississippi Delta over the last century, so that's an area about 2,000 square miles.
Coastal activists say if there's anything good to come from the BP oil spill, it's that restoring Louisiana's coast now appears to be on the national agenda. They believe they finally have an advocate in the White House, now 50 years after scientists first realized how fast Louisiana's coast was disappearing. Still, there are competing ideas about what coastal restoration would look like. For instance, putting back what has been lost or simply stopping the decline. And now there are fears the oil washing ashore will only accelerate the problem. For the Chauvins, the problem is more immediate.
This oil is it's a tragic thing, I ain't gonna lie.
David Chauvin, Jr.
This is the only way of life that me, my brother, my daddy, my papa, his daddy, we all knew. This is something that, matter of fact, this is all I knew. I didn't go to school. I quit in seventh grade. This is all I knew. Engines, trawls, everything you could put on a boat. I think the only time I didn't go shrimping was from 18. I had worked 2 years in the oil field, and it ain't for me. I like trawling. That's just me.
Now he's trawling for oil, trying his best to save what he knows. The well blew on April 20th, and by April 30th, the Chauvins were running Task Force 1 and what would develop into BP's Vessels of Opportunity program, using local fleets to fight the oil. David Chauvin Sr. says it's been good to have that work, but he's wondering what will become of the shrimp and his family's future.
That would be the scariest part out of all of this, that shrimping as we know it would be over with. It could cost me my heritage.
David Chauvin's fear today echoes the sentiment of his great-grandfather Cap more than a half century ago, when oilmen first set foot in the bayou. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
This is NPR. When the first oilmen arrived in Cajun, South Louisiana, the local fishermen feared their way of life was in jeopardy. But over the last half century, the two industries learned to live together. Oil and gas brought jobs and opportunities for many families. Now, with the oil spill in the Gulf, some are asking the question, at what cost? NPR's Debbie Elliott has this story as part of our series, The Disappearing Coast.
In the 1953 film Thunder Bay, Jimmy Stewart, an oilman, comes to the Louisiana Bayou.
Now look down there. All you can see is water. But if you dream real hard, you can smell the oil. Can't you smell it?
He and his partner have a solution to the offshore problem, a barge platform that can plumb the deep Gulf waters. A shrimper's daughter is wary.
They're buying the town. They'll spoil everything they touch. Oil crews with their filthy men and their filthy money.
The old film underscores the decades-long balancing act in Louisiana to harvest its most valuable natural resources, the sweet crude deep below the seafloor and the fertile waters above, teeming with fish and shellfish.
I've always been a man to drag nets in the Gulf, you know.
Anthony Chauvin is a retired shrimper and boat builder who now helps his son David run the Mariah Jade Shrimp Company in Chauvin, Louisiana. The family's roots are in the water.
Grandpa Cap Chauvin, he was the first trawler. My daddy was the second. I'm the third, and David's the fourth, and his kids are the fifth generation.
It's always been a family business, dating back to Grandpa Cap.
He had five daughters and five sons. And his daughters would make nets. They would actually take it and make the webbing, and they'd make enough webbing for him to make a net to go trolling with.
Today, the Chauvins have hung up their nets. The outriggers on their boats instead pull boom through the Gulf of Mexico to catch spilled oil. At 63, Anthony Chauvin is too young to remember when the first oil speculators came to Terrebonne Parish in the 1940s, but he knows his grandfather Cap didn't like it one bit.
When the oil company first came down here with the Cajuns, they didn't want the oil company. And I remember my grandfather talking about this, and they couldn't stop them, you see. So eventually what ended up happening, a lot of the oil people that came down here started hiring them and paying them good money and kind of cleaned it up, and then we buddies together, so that's basically how it went. But at the beginning, it wasn't like that.
By the time Anthony Chauvin was fishing, the oil rigs were just as much a part of the Gulf seascape as the brown shrimp he was chasing.
You know, we live with the oil companies down here, and we get along, and a lot of our friends work with them. And I have worked in the oil field at times. I seen myself in the wintertime fishing wasn't good when I was a young man, so we would go and work for the oil company. And then when the season would come back, we would go back fishing, you know.
Often fishing around the oil platforms, he says, where you could find the most shrimp. A visit to the Aquarium of the Americas in New Orleans helps illustrate the intricate relationship between coastal Louisiana and the oil and gas industry. School-aged children file past the Gulf of Mexico exhibit, some surprised to see that it's sponsored by BP and a host of other oil companies. Mark Davis directs the Institute on Water Resources, Law, and Policy at Tulane University. He says what's inside the giant saltwater tank is telling.
You have sea turtles, you have rays, you have tarpon, all sorts of wonderful-looking things. And you also have what appear to be the legs of an oil rig, because oil rigs, like any hard structure in the Gulf, attract sea life. It essentially becomes the basis for a reef. So even here, we were essentially proudly telling people how integral not only is oil and gas to the sea life in the Gulf and our way of life, but it's essentially become integrated in the entire ecology.
When you look at this exhibit now and you think about what's happening in the Gulf, what goes through your mind?
Well, the irony is almost overwhelming. I think it's a story that's fair to tell, but it's an incomplete story. It suggests that this is a benign relationship, and it's always been a very, very dicey relationship.
Dicey because of the trade-off between protecting the nursery grounds that produce a bountiful Gulf and the need to industrialize a traditionally poor state. Dating back to early European settlers, Davis says, there's been a drive to tame and develop Louisiana's coast.
Culturally, we viewed wetlands during much of that era as wasteland. And even though the people who lived in those regions knew the bounty that came from it, when somebody finally comes to you and says, how would you like to make four times more money than you've ever made in your life? How would you like to have a shot at a different future? It's hard to say no. That looks like progress. And in part, it was. But it was progress with a price that wasn't actually acknowledged.
Until now. Louisiana's wetlands are disappearing at an alarming rate, 25 square miles a year. If that continues, an area the size of the state of Rhode Island will be underwater by 2050. And most scientists say oil and gas activity is responsible for about one-third of the state's total land loss. Looking back, Anthony Chauvin has seen it happen in Terrebonne Parish.
They came up in here and they dug bayous all over the place. Cut across the marsh maybe a mile, 2 miles, and then at the end of that, they'd come set a rig right there. So our marsh was cut open all over the place. That's how it disappeared.
The straight line cuts through the marsh are in stark contrast to the natural curves of the water weaving through stands of cordgrass. Chauvin says despite early wildcat promises of oil riches, families like his don't have much to show for it. He tells the story of an uncle who let the state build a levee behind his house.
Right next to Lake Boudreaux right here. So he got these 14 acres of land on the other side over there, and he watched it just disappear. It went underwater. And then a rig came one day. A rig came in the back over there, and that's where his land was at. And he went to talk to somebody. He says, well, it's part of the lake now. It's almost like they stole it from him. You know what I'm saying? It's your land. But now the water took it. It belonged to the state.
Chauvin wonders now what might have been different had the powers that be listened to his grandfather 70 years ago.
5 generations later, here we are. And are they going to have a 6th one? I really don't know. Is this place going to exist another 20 years from now down here? I really don't know.
Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Back to the Gulf now, where it's nesting season for sea turtles. Soon, thousands of baby hatchlings would be scurrying their way from Gulf Coast beaches down into the ocean. But federal wildlife officials have decided to move the nests out of harm's way, relocating eggs to the Atlantic coast. NPR's Debbie Elliott was there watching when they packed up the first nest in Alabama.
Baby sea turtles already have a deadly obstacle course to navigate as they scamper from their sandy nest in the cover of night. Lights can confuse them as they try to find the ocean. Seabirds can swoop down and scoop them up. And once they hit the Gulf, sharks, fishnets, and other predators await. Up to half of the hatchlings don't make it. But now the odds are even worse.
This is a huge threat.
Mike Reynolds is the director of Alabama's Share the Beach program.
Their habitat, where they're going to, is polluted now.
Turtle Czar is embroidered above the breast pocket of Reynolds' lime green shirt. He oversees some 300 volunteers who comb Alabama's 47 miles of white sand beach at daybreak every morning. They look for the tracks left by female sea turtles who return to the same beach each year to lay their eggs under the soft, damp sand.
Oh, they're just amazing creatures. You just think about, they're beautiful, they're so graceful and beautiful in the water and so efficient, and they survive for millions of years, using this formula of reproducing themselves.
Now, Reynolds' group is helping the incubating turtles to escape their oil-tainted home.
I want you right here by your cooler and the other cooler person right here by their cooler.
The crew is preparing to dig up a 50-day-old loggerhead turtle nest in Gulf Shores, Alabama.
They're not like chicken eggs, not a hard shell egg, so they're kind of leathery, cardboardy kind of consistency. And so when we dig carefully, don't use fingernails, don't use any tools at all. We simply dig with our hands, and usually with the side of our hand, softly, and moving the sand away. And so we get down to where the nest is.
Before long, Sherry Parks finds what she's digging for.
And this is good stuff right here. Like Mama.
Reynolds puts a grease pencil mark on the top side of the egg. Parks gently lifts it out and places it on a layer of sand in a styrofoam travel cooler.
Egg number one.
It takes about a half an hour to unearth all 127 eggs.
They're nice and tight, Miss Jan. They're full of turtles.
Parks says she can feel the head of the baby turtle through the delicate shell. It's hard for her team to part with this nest. They've been protecting it from all the oil cleanup activity underway on the beach.
We're hoping to hear that they all hatched happily and, made water. That's all we can hope for.
It's a bittersweet moment.
The alternative is likely death of the hatchling.
Diane Ingram is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The oil follows the same current patterns as the hatchlings would get caught up in, and it would almost pull them in, and we knew it wouldn't be good.
Ingram says scientists expect a higher mortality rate than the 20% to 50% of baby sea turtles that typically perish each year.
But in the end, more would survive by taking them to the Atlantic than letting them go into the Gulf.
In all, the government plans to move 700 to 800 clutches of eggs, by far the largest turtle nest relocation ever. Ingram says it's a big experiment dictated by extraordinary circumstances. So now, the eggs will stay nestled in the styrofoam containers that have been strapped into a FedEx custom critical van. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. After nearly 3 months and millions of gallons of oil spilling into the Gulf, BP has stopped the flow from its leaking well, at least for now. The oil stopped flowing yesterday afternoon when BP closed the final valves on the well, leading to a tight new cap. And that video everyone's been watching on the web, it now shows no oil escaping into the sea.
But BP and federal officials caution this is only a temporary fix. In a moment, we'll find out what we can expect in the coming days as BP seeks a permanent solution. First, we'll hear from NPR's Greg Allen. He's on the Coast Guard cutter Resolute, which is stationed at the spill site 45 miles out in the Gulf.
We fly out from Plaquemines Parish, the toe of the Louisiana Boot, on a Coast Guard helicopter. It's not until we're about 15 miles from the well site that we begin to see streamers of weathered oil and sheen. Circling over the site, there are three offshore rigs and dozens of ships concentrated in a one-mile area. There's the A-Whale, the massive skimmer. Also, the ships that collect oil flowing up through standing risers, the Helix Producer, the Enterprise, and the Q4000, plus dozens of other skimmers and support vessels. Two of the rigs are drilling relief wells. The third is handling the sealing cap that finally is enabling BP to control the well. Our helicopter touches down on the Coast Guard cutter, Resolute.
Now, nice and on deck. Check the sanitization out of the ship.
For the Coast Guard, this is a big ship, 210 feet with a crew of 70. Coast Guard Lieutenant Patrick Montgomery says it's an armada, an unprecedented concentration of ships in smaller boats.
In a close vicinity to the wellhead, we have approximately 65 vessels within a six-mile range and another 45 to 50 that are in a pretty close area from there. Having 65 vessels in a six-mile range is a controlled chaos. It's very dangerous out there, but so far we've been lucky with the great seamanship and the great cooperation between all the vessels.
The Resolute is based in St. Petersburg, Florida, and is usually deployed for search and rescue and homeland security, drug and migrant interdiction. Here at the source of the spill, it's providing support for the Coast Guard helicopters and boats. But it's also taken on a new mission in the last week, playing host to news organizations. After months of complaints about a lack of access to oiled areas and to the spill site, retired Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen promised to work with the press. The Coast Guard soon began ferrying reporters out to the Resolute. On the ship and all along the Gulf Coast, people are upbeat. For months, tens of thousands of barrels of oil a day have gushed from the open wellhead on the floor of the Gulf. Yesterday's news that BP has closed the sealing cap and finally stopped the flow was greeted by many with elation. BP's Doug Suttles, though, tried to keep his enthusiasm in check.
It's a great sight, but it's far from the finish line. It's not the time to celebrate, I don't think.
At the scene of the spill, the collection of ships and rigs, many here now just call the city, work continues. The cutter Resolute and other ships are withdrawing 6 miles away from the site today while BP conducts seismic testing. But the sense here is that after nearly 90 days, something important has happened. The oil has finally stopped flowing. Greg Allen, NPR News, on the Coast Guard cutter Resolute.
And there's skepticism outside the Gulf, too, about how long the well will stay shut down. For good reason, apparently. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris is with us again now to tell us why. Hey, Richard.
Good morning.
So this is just part of a test, to be clear. There are no promises that this well is going to remain shut down, are there?
That's correct. And let me tell you what the test is about. Let me remind you, they're letting pressure build up inside the well in order to assess its condition. And if the well can hold a lot of pressure, that means it's actually in pretty good shape. But if the pressure is leaking out, that could indicate damage down below. And this information will be useful when it comes time to drill into the well and pump cement into it, we hope in a couple weeks' time. And the newly installed valves also can come into play during that operation as well. So it's sort of part of a large, bigger context here.
So at the end of this test, do they go back to trying to collect some of the oil that's in the well?
It depends what they find. The best case scenario is that the well will simply remain shut. That's clearly what BP would like to do. But last night, National Incident Commander Thad Allen said it remains likely, his words, that they will return to collecting oil at the end of the test. And let me walk you through the possibilities just so we can understand how this might unfold. As I say, if in the best case scenario, they'll just simply leave it shut. But the next best case is they'll open some of the hoses that are already attached down in the blowout preventer and pipe the oil to the surface. And those two hoses together can handle about 30,000 barrels of oil a day. there's probably more than that in the well, so that may or may not be enough to satisfy their pressure concerns. If they do need to collect more, they'll add another ship, and the ship called the Enterprise is actually standing by. But I will caution that the process of hooking up that ship will almost certainly end up putting oil into the water, maybe for a couple of days even. So we could see more oil in the water under that scenario. And again, that may not be enough. That ship plus what's down there is 50,000 barrels a day. That could well cover what oil is in there, but they may actually need more than that. There are ships that can add that capacity, but they won't be ready for more than a week. So one footnote here is one thing we've been interested all along is how much oil is spilling out. If they leave the well shut, we may actually never get a really final definitive answer for that. And so Representative Ed Markey, a Democrat of Massachusetts, says he would like to see oil flow back up to the surface safely, if possible, of course, so that we can actually finally measure how much oil is coming out.
Well, and we've also talked a lot about the weather, which has affected operations there greatly. I know this is forecast to be a record-breaking hurricane season. Safe to assume there's planning going on for future weather problems.
That's a big concern, because if they can close down the well, then they don't have to worry about hurricanes. But if they decide that they need to collect oil again, at some point, the ships on the surface will have to leave. And during that time, there's no way to collect that oil. So for that period of time, oil will continue to spew into the Gulf. So that's another consideration about, can you just shut it down or do you want to collect the oil?
And just quickly, the permanent solution is going to be this relief well. Where does that stand?
That's been put on hold for a couple of days. They didn't want to keep drilling during this test just in case that they ran into problems. And they certainly don't want to damage the relief well. But there's still hope that end of this month, maybe early August, that will be ready to go, and they'll put cement down, and that will be really the end of the story.
Okay. Thanks, Richard.
My pleasure.
That's NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Let's go now to New Orleans, where people have been anxiously following every development. NPR's Kathy Lohr stopped in at an oyster house where people had just heard that the oil was no longer gushing into the Gulf.
There's a bit of excitement at Bourbon House, but it's tempered after nearly 3 months of waiting. Larry Brooks shucks oysters behind a giant marble oyster bar. He says many in the city have lost jobs or had to cut hours because there aren't as many oysters to serve.
Well, we love the fact that it stopped, you know. We could just hope for the best and hope they can get it all cleared up. And we could just keep shucking.
One of the floor managers at the Bourbon House, Henry Soviak, says people have been on pins and needles, worrying every day. And he's not convinced it's over. After all, he says, BP has made so many other efforts to cap the well, and those failed.
Let's give it a while, but I'm relieved right now. I'm not happy by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm relieved. I hope that this is the fix. I hope this is what stops all that oil, and we can go back to our lives.
So today's news is huge. It really is huge, but we're being cautiously optimistic.
Ewell Smith is with the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board. He's still worried about the fishermen, with 35% of the federal fishing waters along the Gulf closed. Smith also worries about the job ahead, convincing people that seafood from the Gulf is still safe to eat.
It's been an ongoing hurricane for us for 3 months almost. And now we need to figure out what the pieces are so we can start picking them up and putting them back together. And we can start rebuilding our brand for Louisiana seafood across the nation.
Smith says people here are skeptical and tired. Tired of the oil and tired of the promises. And people here know even if the leak is stopped, the cleanup is really just beginning. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, New Orleans.